This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington. President Obama is expected to appear soon in the East Room of the White House to take questions from reporters. There is no shortage of topics to discuss in this news conference. His vice president is soon to propose gun control regulations. We're expecting an announcement this week. The president has been sending nominees for cabinet posts to Congress, and some of them have been exciting a lot of debate. There's the matter of immigration reform. The president's second inauguration is a week away, and above all this is the possible fight, or perhaps we should say likely fight, over raising the federal borrowing limit. Republicans in Congress have spoken of refusing to raise the debt ceiling, as it's called, unless President Obama agrees to their budget demands, which would leave the government unable to pay some of the spending obligations that Congress has approved in the past. We're joined now, as we wait on the presidential news conference, by NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley, who's covered the president for years. Scott, good morning.
Good to be with you, Steve.
Okay, so the president has said up to now on the question of the debt ceiling, I'm not going to negotiate with Congress over this. Is that still his position?
It is. And this week, the White House sort of raised the stakes there by closing one of the escape hatches that had been floated out there in the blogosphere. They had previously, of course, said that the president wasn't going to invoke the 14th Amendment. That was something that he kind of ruled out last time that this came up.
This is a phrase in the Constitution that says that the federal debt shall not be questioned. You could interpret that as saying I have to pay the debts regardless.
That's right. But the White House counsel had said back in the summer of 2011 that they weren't going to use that as an escape hatch to let Congress off the hook for raising the debt ceiling. So then some folks had floated the idea that maybe they could mint a trillion-dollar coin, put that on deposit at the Federal Reserve, and use that money to have some extra headroom to pay the government's bills.
Which is a perfect proposal to talk about in the blogosphere, as you mentioned. I mean, that's just ideal for the blogosphere.
It's a silly response to a silly situation that we find ourselves in. But the White House has said, look, this is no time for silliness. So this weekend they ruled out the prospect of minting a trillion-dollar coin or any other denomination of coin to avoid the debt ceiling. And they've said, look, it's up to Congress. You either raise the debt ceiling or we default. So they've basically said, we're in a game of chicken, and it's now tag, you're it.
And there's no, basically what the president is saying by, I'm not going to invoke the 14th Amendment. I'm not going to take responsibility on myself. I'm not going to do this trillion-dollar coin idea, however legal it may theoretically be. He's basically saying, in this game of chicken, there are no curbs, or we're putting up higher curbs. There's no place to swerve, is what the president
That's right. He said it's Congress's job. You put the debt ceiling into place. You need to deal with it.
Also in our studios is NPR's Tamara Keith, who covers Congress. Tamara, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Let me ask you how strongly congressional leaders are feeling about repeating the crisis of 2011 when they pushed the debt ceiling deadline right down to the end.
Well, in some ways, they probably felt that was pretty effective. They did get $1 trillion in cuts, followed by an additional $1 trillion, which sort of through the sequester, the automatic spending cuts set up the big fiscal cliff debate that we just had.
Yeah.
Basically set up the fight we're in now, which is just like part three or four of the fight we've been having. And I think that I'm not sure exactly where leadership is. I know that quite a few members of the House Republican caucus feel like this is a fight to have and a fight they're absolutely willing to have. And they are willing to walk right up to that debt limit or maybe even go over it.
And I should mention that we're in the midst of several deadlines. One was the so-called fiscal cliff at the end of the year. Another is the debt ceiling. We don't have a precise, by the way, precise date. Is that right? Sometime in February?
Yeah, I mean, they're basically searching for money in the couch cushions right now, and they keep finding stuff, moving things around. And I'm hearing around February 15th, but they could stretch it a little bit longer.
If only they'd find that trillion-dollar coin in the couch cushions, this would solve the whole thing. Scott Horsley?
We actually bumped up against the debt ceiling at the end of 2012, and the Treasury Department is now using what they call extraordinary measures to sort of stall for time, and they can do that for a certain amount of time. But yeah, estimates are that come mid-February to early March, we're really going to be up against it, and the Treasury won't actually be able to pay all the bills.
And am I mistaken about this? There's yet another deadline because the overall law that allows the government to function is set to expire in March, right, Tamara?
Right, and that's at the end of March. That's a continuing resolution. Basically, we haven't had an actual budget in ages. And so we've been doing these temporary budgets that keep the government funded. And that would expire at the end of March. Before that, we also have the sequester. That's the automatic spending cuts that were supposed to hit at the beginning of this year. Well, they pushed them off as part of that end-of-the-year deal. Well, that comes right at the end of February, beginning of March. So basically, we have a storm of multiple things. One way this could happen is the president could refuse to negotiate on the debt ceiling, but he could negotiate on any number of these other crises we're about to hit and resolve the whole thing or not.
Can I ask about one thing, Tamara, that was reported by Politico? Good reporters there, a number of good reporters on this story. It's an anonymous quote, though, from a Republican leadership advisor. And the suggestion is that it may be necessary to force a government shutdown as a matter of member management, meaning Republican leaders may not really want a government shutdown, but they've got some members who are so determined to do something dramatic about what they see as a spending problem that at least a government shutdown may be necessary to force. What are people telling you?
Well, and I obviously have not spoken to that same person. I don't know who that person is exactly, but absolutely, The Speaker John Boehner has an unruly conference on his hand. It's unclear exactly how many of his members are willing to go over the edge, but a large number are. A large number of House Republicans feel like this is their leverage point.
And Scott Horsley, it certainly gives Boehner more leverage to have people rumbling that really they are willing to go over the edge.
Yeah, if you're in a game of chicken, the crazier you seem, the better your advantage. But we should distinguish between a government shutdown, which maybe is needed for member management, and a default of the federal government, which would be catastrophic for all concerned. And to the extent that you have members of Congress saying we're willing to default on the U.S. debts, then you really have lunatics running the asylum.
Let me just remind people that we are awaiting a presidential news conference. President Obama is expected to come to the East Room of the White House, perhaps in the next few minutes, as soon as 11:30 Eastern Time, 8:30 Pacific, and we will bring you live coverage of that. A variety of subjects may come up, and one of them certainly is gun control, and that's why NPR's Carrie Johnson has also joined us this morning. She's been closely following the debate over gun control, particularly after the shootings in Newtown, Massachusetts late last year. And Carrie, let's talk about what is expected in the week to come. The Vice President, Joe Biden, is expected to speak to this issue tomorrow.
Vice President Biden is expected to put forward a series of proposals, what he calls comprehensive proposals, as early as tomorrow, Tuesday, Steve. But even before then, mayors and governors of Democratic states all over the country have been engaging in a conversation. I just came back earlier today from a meeting at the Center for American Progress, which is a left-leaning organization that has about 12 proposals on the table, 12 or 13 proposals on the table now. It wants to see the vice president advance.
What sort of proposals? Like, if you're looking from a leftward perspective, what are some things you could try to do here?
The three most important things, Steve, would be a ban on assault weapons, a universal background check system, background checks for people no matter where they purchase a weapon. Not just federally licensed gun dealers, but at gun shows on the internet and elsewhere. Right now, estimates are 40% or more guns in the country are purchased without those kind of background checks. And finally, some kind of ban or limit on high-capacity magazines, the kinds of magazines that carry 30 or more bullets or pieces of ammunition that allow criminals to slaughter lots and lots of people without ever having to reload their weapon.
Okay, so restrict the types of weapons, which is something that was tried in the 1990s, get better background checks, and also restrict the types of ammunition, three general proposals that can be made. Of course, one of the challenges here is what can you get consensus on? If you look on the rightward side of the spectrum, is there anything from that list that people on the right might be able to sign on to?
Everybody seems to agree, Steve, that the Justice Department and state and local prosecutors should enforce the laws already on the books. So what that means is prosecuting criminals, prosecuting felons who seek to buy weapons and are busted at the point of sale, prosecuting people who lie to allow other people to get weapons, and cracking down on gun trafficking. So those are things that are illegal throughout the country for the most part, but prosecutors tend to not devote a lot of resources to them because, especially in certain parts of the country, Steve, juries don't like those kind of cases. So they carry very minimal prison sentences, mm-hmm. 6 months, sometimes less, and prosecutors have not spent a lot of time enforcing those laws.
So enforcing the existing laws is actually, I mean, it sounds very straightforward, but it's not as easy as it sounds.
It's not as easy as it sounds, and in fact, a lot of people on the political left are calling for much higher penalties, criminal penalties, prison sentences, and the like.
Haven't I heard a little bit of discussion in recent days, though, that people on the right, gun rights advocates, might at least be willing to give some ground when it comes to the question of background checks? There might be something more that can be done in that area that they would sign on to and not block.
Yeah, it's not clear that they would support universal background checks, which is something Vice President Joe Biden has talked about.
What does that mean? That means regardless of where you go, regardless of how you buy, even a gun show, no loopholes, you get background check. That's what that means.
That's okay. Exactly right. And frankly, I was at an event this morning with Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who said things like that, which are considered to be loopholes, are actually huge gaping exceptions to the law. So if you have a loophole that big, he says, you really don't have an effective law.
I'm so glad that you mentioned Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, because, of course, he used to be a congressman, and he led Democratic congressional campaigns that were very successful. For example, in 2006, when the Democrats took over Congress, a big part of that was that Democrats quieted their opposition to weapons in this country, quieted their advocacy for gun control, didn't necessarily change positions, stopped talking about it, and embraced some more conservative Democrats. Let me ask Scott Horsley, who's still with us as we await this presidential news conference, is President Obama and are the Democrats generally in a position where they truly are willing to take on the political risk of pushing for tighter gun control, or is this just something they want to seem to be doing?
Well, I think President Obama has said he's willing to take on the risk, but of course he doesn't have to run for re-election again, and that puts him sort of in a unique position here in Washington. Certainly some Democrats in bluer states, in parts of the country where gun ownership is not as big an issue, urban areas, they might be more willing to go out on a limb like that, but Democrats who have to run statewide, Democrats who have to run in red territory, that's a much different issue. And, you know, when Kerry talks about some of these proposals that the vice president's been looking at, we've seen polling data that shows widespread support for the universal background checks. But when you think about how do you do that as a practical matter, how do you say that if, Steve, I sell you my gun here at the office, how do we require a background check on that short of actually having some sort of registration of all weapons? So as even though there's broad public support for universal background checks, as a practical matter, that gets into some pretty risky political territory as well.
Well, Tamara Keith, does Congress even have the capacity to deal with this, given everything else they have to deal with?
They have a whole lot to deal with. My sense is that we won't be dealing with anything other than debt and deficit talk and potential shutdowns until at least the end of March. And by then, it's unclear how much pressure will still remain on this issue of guns. And the reality is that the House is controlled by Republicans. Republicans have historically not favored these types of proposals at all. So there's no reason why any of this legislation would ever come to the floor.
And as we await this presidential news conference, which will be in the East Room of the White House and which we're expecting in the next few minutes, let me bring another voice into the conversation. NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman has covered the U.S. military for years, and it's been an interesting few months in the military because big defense cuts have been looming. They were agreed to as part of the debt ceiling fight back in 2011. They were to take effect at the end of 2012. They were delayed but not canceled until a couple of months from now. And now the question is, what happens? Tom Bowman is on the line. And Tom, let me ask you, how serious are these defense cuts? How major are they if they were to take effect and truly become law?
Well, we don't know exactly at this point what kind of cuts we're looking at. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has said the services have to get ready for these cuts, possible furloughs of civilians, possible holding off on training for pilots and soldiers and so forth. They're saying, you know, hundreds of billions in cuts could be devastating to the military. But at this point, we don't know exactly what's going to happen. Clearly, there will likely be more cuts in the Pentagon, but exactly how much, we don't know at this point.
I guess we should be clear. The current law just says across the board cuts a little bit or maybe a lot from everything, right? That's why, and the question is how, if at all, they'll adjust that?
Yeah, that's a real problem. Across the board cuts where it's basically X percentage. and you can't make decisions on taking it from one place or the other. It's just everything across the board, and that's what really troubles Pentagon leaders. They say they can't target any of these cuts. It's just across the board.
You know, Tom Bowman, you say furloughing civilians. When you just say that, that actually doesn't sound that bad. You figure, well, the soldiers are still out there fighting. Some civilians get furloughed. It's the Pentagon. That's not a big deal. But isn't this an institution, the military generally, that relies tremendously on civil service people, on civilians of different kinds, in fact, more and more on civilians to do jobs that had been done by the uniformed services in the past?
Oh, absolutely. And there are 800,000 Pentagon civilians, so it could have a big impact not only on the day-to-day operations of the Pentagon, but the economy as well. I mean, you're talking about weeks, perhaps, of furloughs. And you're right, you're talking about people that used to do, you know, the military used to do some of these jobs. Now they've been taken over by civilians. But it will not have an impact on ongoing operations in Afghanistan, however. That's what we're being told.
Scott Horsley and Tamara Keith, let me ask you, because you've been following the political debate over this. These defense cuts are something that Republicans have been urging should be reworked or canceled. Democrats have not been urging it so strongly, but some have agreed that it's not the best idea to do it in the way that it's currently structured. Who gets leverage out of the fact that these defense cuts are looming over everyone?
Well, when the sequester was first set up, it was seen as giving the White House, giving Democrats some leverage, because they were Democrats were less concerned about the cuts to defense, and key Democratic priorities, notably government spending on health care, are largely protected from the automatic spending cuts. But President Obama is also the commander-in-chief, and so he's more sensitive to those defense cuts than some of the Democrats in Congress are, and he's more anxious to see something else swapped out for them. When they did replace the automatic spending cuts for the month of January and February, when they sort of bought off 2 months of extra time there, they replaced half of the automatic spending cuts with a revenue hike. They're going to make some extra tax money by making changes in the way people can deal with their retirement accounts. The White House sees that as a model for going forward, that none of the cuts would have to be as draconian if we could get some of the money from new taxes or higher taxes. Republicans have said, no, we're done dealing with taxes. You got all the tax money out of us that you're going to in the end of year debts, fiscal cliff fight, and now we're just about spending cuts.
Just a reminder, we are preparing for a presidential news conference, which we're now told is just a few seconds away. NPR's Tamara Keith, Carrie Johnson, Scott Horsley, Tom Bowman, and others are listening in with us. There could be a wide variety of topics, ranging from the budget to the debt ceiling fight. We haven't even had a chance yet to talk about immigration, but that could very well also come up. One of the questions is whether this year, or at least in this Congress, there may be a possibility for some kind of accommodation to be reached on the subject of immigration reform, as its advocates would call it. That's a subject that has bedeviled presidents from both parties for quite a number of years, and the struggle goes on. President Obama is calling this news conference on a Monday, just a week before his inauguration. He will take the oath of office in a quiet ceremony on Sunday, January 20th, as prescribed by the Constitution, and then on January 21st, Martin Luther King Day, the official holiday, there will be a formal inauguration. Perhaps, Scott Horsley, not as huge as 4 years ago, a more historic occasion, not a change of power here, but still it's an inauguration. It's a big event.
That's right. And of course, he got to do it twice last time, too, because they muffed the official oath. This time they'll do it in reverse order. They'll do the private ceremony first and the big public ceremony second. Last time it was the other way around.
How meaningful is this for the president to have won it twice, to be there twice?
Oh, he sees this as huge. He has said that the first election, in some ways, he was kind of a blank slate. This time, he said it feels more real. This time, he knows people were really endorsing what he saw as his own agenda, not projecting something onto a sort of an empty vessel.
And let's go to President Obama now, stepping up to the lectern.
Please have a seat, everybody. Good morning. I thought it might make sense to take some questions this week as my first term comes to an end. It's been a busy and productive 4 years, and I expect the same for the next 4 years. I intend to carry out the agenda that I campaigned on, an agenda for new jobs, new opportunity, and new security for the middle class. Now, right now, our economy is growing, and our businesses are creating new jobs. So we are poised for a good year if we make smart decisions and sound investments, and as long as Washington politics don't get in the way of America's progress. As I said on the campaign, one component to growing our economy and broadening opportunity for the middle class is shrinking our deficits in a balanced and responsible way. And for nearly 2 years now, I've been fighting for such a plan, one that would reduce our deficits by $4 trillion over the next decade, which would stabilize our debt and our deficit in a sustainable way for the next decade. That would be enough not only to stop the growth of our debt relative to the size of our economy, but it would make it manageable so it doesn't crowd out the investments we need to make in people and education and job training and science and medical research, all the things that help us grow. Now, step by step, we've made progress towards that goal. Over the past 2 years, I've signed into law about $1.4 trillion in spending cuts. 2 weeks ago, I signed into law more than $600 billion in new revenue by making sure the wealthiest Americans begin to pay their fair share. When you add the money that we'll save in interest payments on the debt, altogether, that adds up to a total of about $2.5 trillion in deficit reduction over the past 2 years, not counting the $400 billion already saved from winding down the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we've made progress. We are moving towards our ultimate goal of getting to a $4 trillion reduction. And there will be more deficit reduction when Congress decides what to do about the $1.2 trillion in automatic spending cuts that have been pushed off until next month. The fact is, though, we can't finish the job of deficit reduction through spending cuts alone. The cuts we've already made to priorities other than Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and defense mean that we spend on everything from education to public safety less as a share of our economy than it has than has been true for a generation. And that's not a recipe for growth. So we've got to do more both to stabilize our finances over the medium and long term, but also spur more growth in the short term. Now, I've said I'm open to making modest adjustments to programs like Medicare to protect them for future generations. And I've also said that we need more revenue through tax reform, by closing loopholes in our tax code for the wealthiest Americans. If we combine a balanced package of savings from spending on health care and revenues from closing loopholes, we can solve the deficit issue without sacrificing our investments in things like education that are going to help us grow. Turns out the American people agree with me. They listened to an entire year's debate over this issue, and they made a clear decision about the approach they prefer. They don't think it's fair, for example, to ask a senior to pay more for his or her health care or a scientist to shut down life-saving research so that a multimillionaire investor can pay less in tax rates than a secretary. They don't think it's smart to protect endless corporate loopholes and tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans rather than rebuild our roads and our schools, invest in our workers' skills, or help manufacturers bring jobs back to America. So they want us to get our books in order in a balanced way, where everybody pulls their weight, everyone does their part. That's what I want as well. That's what I've proposed. And we can get it done, but we're going to have to make sure that people are looking at this in a responsible way, rather than just through the lens of politics. Now, the other congressionally imposed deadline coming up is the so-called debt ceiling, something most Americans hadn't even heard of before 2 years ago. So I want to be clear about this. The debt ceiling is not a question of authorizing more spending. Raising the debt ceiling does not authorize more spending. It simply allows the country to pay for spending that Congress has already committed to. These are bills that have already been racked up, and we need to pay them. So while I'm willing to compromise and find common ground over how to reduce our deficits, America cannot afford another debate with this Congress about whether or not they should pay the bills they've already racked up. If congressional Republicans refuse to pay America's bills on time, Social Security checks and veterans benefits will be delayed. We might not be able to pay our troops or honor our contracts with small business owners, food inspectors, air traffic controllers, specialists who track down loose nuclear materials wouldn't get their paychecks. Investors around the world will ask if the United States of America is, in fact, a safe bet. Markets could go haywire. Interest rates would spike for anybody who borrows money. Every homeowner with a mortgage, every student with a college loan, every small business owner who wants to grow and hire. It would be a self-inflicted wound on the economy. It would slow down our growth, might tip us into recession, and ironically, would probably increase our deficit. So to even entertain the idea of this happening, of the United States of America not paying its bills, is irresponsible. It's absurd. As the Speaker said 2 years ago, it would be, and I'm quoting Speaker Boehner now, a financial disaster not only for us, but for the worldwide economy. So we've got to pay our bills. And Republicans in Congress have two choices here. They can act responsibly and pay America's bills, or they can act irresponsibly and put America through another economic crisis. But they will not collect a ransom in exchange for not crashing the American economy. The financial well-being of the American people is not leveraged to be used. The full faith and credit of the United States of America is not a bargaining chip. And they'd better choose quickly because time is running short. The last time Republicans in Congress even flirted with this idea, our AAA credit rating was downgraded for the first time in our history. Our business has created the fewest jobs of any month in nearly the past 3 years. And ironically, the whole fiasco actually added to the deficit. So it shouldn't be surprising, given all this talk, that the American people think Washington is hurting rather than helping the country at the moment. They see their representatives consumed with partisan brinksmanship over paying our bills, while they overwhelmingly want us to focus on growing the economy and creating more jobs. So let's finish this debate. Let's give our businesses and the world the certainty that our economy and our reputation are still second to none. We pay our bills, we handle our business, and then we can move on, because America has a lot to do. We've got to create more jobs, we've got to boost the wages of those who have work, we've got to reach for energy independence, we've got to reform our immigration system, we've got to give our children the best education possible, and we've got to do everything we can to protect them from the horrors of gun violence. And let me say I'm grateful to Vice President Biden for his work on this issue of gun violence and for his proposals, which I'm going to be reviewing today, and I will address the next few days, and I intend to vigorously pursue. So with that, I'm going to take some questions, and I'm going to start with Julie Pace of AP, and I want to congratulate Julie for this new important job.
I wanted to ask about gun violence. Mm-hmm. Today marks the 1 year or 1 month anniversary of the shooting in Newtown, which seemed to generate some momentum for reinstating the assault weapons ban. But there's been fresh opposition to that ban from the NRA, and even Harry Reid has said that he questions whether it could pass Congress. Mm-hmm. Given that, how hard will you push for an assault weapons ban? And if one cannot pass Congress, what other measures would need to be included in a broad package in order to curb gun violence successfully?
Well, as I said, the Vice President and a number of members of my cabinet went through a very thorough process over the last month, meeting with a lot of stakeholders in this, including the NRA, listened to proposals from all quarters, and they've presented me now with a list of sensible, common sense steps that can be taken to make sure that the kinds of violence we saw at Newtown doesn't happen again. I'm going to be meeting with the Vice President today. I expect to have a fuller presentation later in the week to give people some specifics about what I think we need to do. My starting point is not to worry about the politics. My starting point is to focus on what makes sense. what works. What should we be doing to make sure that our children are safe and that we're reducing the incidence of gun violence? And I think we can do that in a sensible way that comports with the Second Amendment. And then members of Congress, I think, are going to have a debate and examine their own conscience. Because, you know, if in fact, and I believe this is true, everybody across party lines was as deeply moved and saddened as I was by what happened in Newtown, then you know, we're going to have to vote based on what we think is best. We're going to have to come up with answers that set politics aside. And that's what I expect Congress to do. But what you can count on is that the things that I've said in the past, the belief that we have to have stronger background checks, that we can do a much better job in terms of keeping these magazine clips with high capacity out of the hands of folks who shouldn't have them, an assault weapons ban that is meaningful, that those are things I continue to believe make sense. Okay, will all of them get through this Congress? I don't know. But what's uppermost in my mind is making sure that I'm honest with the American people and with members of Congress about what I think will work, what I think is something that will make a difference. And to repeat what I've said earlier, if there is a step we can take that will save even one child from what happened in Newtown, we should take that step. I'll present the details later in the week. Chuck Todd, NBC.
Thank you, sir. As you know, Senate Democrats, Harry Reid sent you a letter begging you, essentially, to consider some sort of executive action on this debt ceiling issue. I know you've said you're not negotiating on it. Your administration has ruled out the various ideas that have been out there, the 14th Amendment, but just this morning, one of the House Democratic leaders, Jim Clyburn, asked you to use the 14th Amendment and even said, sometimes that's what it takes. He brought up the Emancipation Proclamation as saying it took executive action when Congress wouldn't act, and he compared the debt ceiling to that. So are you considering a Plan B? And if not, why not?
Well, Chuck, the issue here is whether or not America pays its bills. We are not a deadbeat nation. And so there's a very simple solution to this. Congress authorizes us to pay our bills. Now, if the House and the Senate want to give me the authority so that they don't have to take these tough votes, if they want to put the responsibility on me to raise the debt ceiling, I'm happy to take it. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, had a proposal like that last year, and I'm happy to accept it. But if they want to keep this responsibility, then they need to go ahead and get it done. And you know, there are no magic tricks here. There are no loopholes. There are no easy outs. This is a matter of Congress authorizes spending. They order me to spend. They tell me you need to fund our Defense Department at such and such a level. You need to send out Social Security checks. You need to make sure that you are paying to care for our veterans. They lay all this out for me, and because they have the spending power, and so I am required by law to go ahead and pay these bills. Separately, they also have to authorize a raising of the debt ceiling in order to make sure that those bills are paid. And so what Congress can't do is tell me to spend X and then say, but we're not going to give you the authority to go ahead and pay the bills. And I just want to repeat, because I think sometimes the American people understandably aren't following all the debates here in Washington, raising the debt ceiling does not authorize us to spend more. All it does is say that America will pay its bills. And we are not a deadbeat nation. And the consequences of us not paying our bills, as I outlined in my opening statement, would be disastrous. So I understand the impulse to try to get around this in a simple way. But there's one way to get around this. There's one way to deal with it, and that is for Congress to authorize me to pay for those items of spending that they have already authorized. And the notion that Republicans in the House, or maybe some Republicans in the Senate, would suggest that in order for us to get our way on our spending priorities, that we would risk the full faith and credit of the United States, that I think is not what the founders intended. That's not how I think most Americans think our democracy should work. They've got a point of view. Democrats in Congress have a point of view. They need to sit down and work out a compromise. Yeah.
So if you're not negotiating, and they say you have to negotiate, and you're not considering another plan B, then you just wait it out. And you go, we do see all these things.
Well, look, Chuck. There's a pretty straightforward way of doing this, and that is to set the debt ceiling aside. We pay our bills, and then we have a vigorous debate about how we're going to do further deficit reduction in a balanced way. Now, keep in mind that what we've heard from some Republicans in both the House and the Senate is that they will only increase the debt ceiling by the amount of spending cuts that they're able to push through. And in order to replace the automatic spending cuts, the sequester, that's $1.2 trillion. Say it takes another trillion or trillion two to get us through one more year, they'd have to identify $2.5 trillion in cuts just to get the debt ceiling extended to next year. $2.5 trillion. Congress has not been able to identify $1.2 trillion in cuts that they're happy with. Because these same Republicans say they don't want to cut defense. They've claimed that they don't want to gut Medicare or harm the vulnerable, but the truth of the matter is that you can't meet their own criteria without drastically cutting Medicare or having an impact on Medicaid or affecting our defense spending. So the math just doesn't add up. Now, here's what would work. What would work would be for us to say we've already done close to $2 trillion in deficit reduction, and if you add the interest that we won't be paying because of less spending and increased revenue, it adds up to about $2.5 trillion. The consensus is we need about $4 trillion to stabilize our debt and our deficit, which means we need about $1.5 trillion more. The package that I offered to Speaker Boehner before the new year would achieve that. We were actually fairly close in terms of arriving at that number. So if the goal is to make sure that we are being responsible about our debt and our deficit, if that's the conversation we're having, I'm happy to have that conversation. And by closing some additional loopholes through tax reform, which Speaker Boehner has acknowledged can raise money in a sensible way, and by doing some additional cuts, including making sure that we are reducing our health care spending, which is the main driver of our deficits, we can arrive at a package that gets this thing done. I'm happy to have that conversation. What I will not do is to have that negotiation with a gun at the head of the American people. The threat that unless we get our way, unless you gut Medicare or Medicaid, or otherwise slash things that the American people don't believe should be slashed, that we're going to threaten to wreck the entire economy. That is not how historically this has been done. That's not how we're going to do it this time. Chuck, what I'm saying to you is that there is no simpler solution, no ready, credible solution, other than Congress either give me the authority to raise the debt ceiling or exercise the responsibility that they have kept for themselves and raise the debt ceiling, because this is about paying your bills. Everybody here understands this. I mean, this is not a complicated concept. You don't go out to dinner and then, you know, eat all you want and then leave without paying the check. And if you do, you're breaking the law. And Congress should think about it the same way that the American people do. You don't. Now, if Congress wants to have a debate about maybe we shouldn't go out to dinner next time, maybe we should go to a more modest restaurant, that's fine. That's a debate that we should have. But you don't say, in order for me to control my appetites, I'm going to not pay the people who already provided me services, people who already lent me the money. That's not showing any discipline. All that's doing is not meeting your obligations. You can't do that. And that's not a credible way to run this government. We've got to stop lurching from crisis to crisis to crisis when there's this clear path ahead of us that simply requires some discipline, some responsibility, and some compromise. That's where we need to go. That's how this needs to work. Major Garrett.
Live coverage of a presidential news conference on NPR News.
As you well know, sir, finding votes for the debt ceiling can sometimes be complicated. Yeah. You yourself, as a member of the Senate, voted against a debt ceiling increase. And in previous aspects of American history, President Reagan in 1985, President George Herbert Walker Bush in 1990, President Clinton in 1997, all signed deficit reduction deals that were contingent upon or in the context of raising the debt ceiling. You yourself four times have done that. Three times, those were related to deficit reduction or budget maneuvers. What Chuck and I, and I think many people are curious about, is this new adamant desire on your part not to negotiate when that seems to conflict with the entire history in the modern era of American presidents and the debt ceiling and your own history in the debt ceiling. And doesn't that suggest that we are going to go into a default situation because no one is talking to each other about how to resolve this?
Well, no, Major. I think if you look at the history, getting votes for the debt ceiling is always difficult. And budgets in this town are always difficult. I went through this just last year. But what's different is we never saw a situation, as we saw last year, in which certain groups in Congress took such an absolutist position that we came within a few days of defaulting. And you know, the fact of the matter is that we have never seen the debt ceiling used in this fashion, where the notion was, you know what, we might default unless we get 100% of what we want. That hasn't happened. Now, as I indicated before, I'm happy to have a conversation about how we reduce our deficits further in a sensible way. Although one thing I want to point out is that the American people are also concerned about how we grow our economy, how we put people back to work, how we make sure that we finance our workers getting properly trained and our schools are giving our kids the education we deserve. There's a whole growth agenda which will reduce our deficits that's important as well. But what you've never seen is the notion that has been presented so far, at least, by the Republicans, that deficit reduction will only count spending cuts, that we will raise the deficit or the debt ceiling dollar for dollar on spending cuts. There are a whole set of rules that have been established that are impossible to meet without doing severe damage to the economy. And so what we're not going to do is put ourselves in a position where in order to pay for spending that we've already incurred, that our two options are we're either going to profoundly hurt the economy and hurt middle-class families and hurt seniors and hurt kids who are trying to go to college, or alternatively, we're going to blow up the economy. We're not going to do that. No, not whatever Congress sends me. They're going to have to send me something that's sensible. And we shouldn't be doing this. We shouldn't be doing this on a 1 to 3 month time frame. Why would we do that? This is the United States of America, Major. We can't manage our affairs in such a way that we pay our bills and we provide some certainty in terms of how we pay our bills? Hey, look, I don't think anybody would consider my position unreasonable here. Major, I am happy to have a conversation about how we reduce our deficits. I'm not going to have a monthly or every 3 months conversation about whether or not we pay our bills, because that in and of itself does severe damage. Even the threat of default hurts our economy. It's hurting our economy as we speak. We shouldn't be having that debate. If we want to have a conversation about how to reduce our deficit, let's have that. We've been having that for the last 2 years. We just had an entire campaign about it. And by the way, the American people agreed with me that we should reduce our deficits in a balanced way that also takes into account the need for us to grow this economy and put people back to work. And despite that conversation, and despite the election results, the position that's been taken on the part of some House Republicans is that, nope, we got to do it our way. And if we don't, we simply won't pay America's bills. Well, you know, that can't be a position that is sustainable over time. It's not one that's good for the economy now. It's certainly not going to be the kind of precedent that I want to establish, not just for my presidency, but for future presidents. Even if it was on the other side. You know, Democrats don't like voting for the debt ceiling when a Republican's president, and yet you never saw a situation in which Democrats suggested somehow that we would go ahead and default if we didn't get 100% of our way. That's just not how it's supposed to work. John Carl.
Thank you, Mr. President. On the issue of guns, given how difficult it will be, some would say impossible, to get any gun control measure passed through this Congress, what are you willing or able to do using the powers of your presidency to act without Congress? And I'd also like to know, what do you make of these long lines we're seeing at gun shows and gun stores all around the country? I mean, even in Connecticut, applications for guns are up since the shooting in Newtown.
Well, my understanding is the Vice President's going to provide a range of steps that we can take to reduce gun violence. Some of them will require legislation. Some of them I can accomplish through executive action. And so I'll be reviewing those today, and as I said, I'll speak in more detail to what we're going to go ahead and propose later in the week. But I'm confident that there are some steps that we can take that don't require legislation and that are within my authority as president. And where you get a step that has the opportunity to reduce the possibility of gun violence, then I want to go ahead and take it. Well, you know, I think, for example, how we are gathering data, for example, on guns that fall into the hands of criminals and how we track that more effectively. There may be some steps that we can take administratively as opposed through legislation. As far as people lining up and purchasing more guns, I think that we've seen for some time now that those who oppose any common sense gun control or gun safety measures have a pretty effective way of ginning up fear on the part of gun owners that somehow the federal government's about to take all your guns away. And you know, that there's probably an economic element to that. It obviously is good for business. But I think that you know, those of us who look at this problem have repeatedly said that responsible gun owners, people who have a gun for protection, for hunting, for sportsmanship, they don't have anything to worry about. The issue here is not whether or not we believe in the Second Amendment. The issue is, are there some sensible steps that we can take to make sure that somebody like the individual in Newtown can't walk into a school and gun down a bunch of children in a shockingly rapid fashion. And surely we can do something about that. But part of the challenge that we confront is that even the slightest hint of some sensible, responsible legislation in this area fans this notion that somehow here it comes and that everybody's guns are going to be taken away. It's unfortunate, but that's the case. And if you look at over the first 4 years of my administration, we've tried to tighten up and enforce some of the laws that were already on the books. But it'd be pretty hard to argue that somehow gun owners have had their rights infringed. Excuse me? Well, as I said, I think it's a fear that's fanned by those who are worried about the possibility of any legislation getting out there.
Live coverage of a presidential news conference from NPR News.
Juliana Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just want to come back to the debt ceiling, because in the summer of 2011, you said that you wouldn't negotiate on the debt ceiling, and you did. Last year, you said that you wouldn't extend any of the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, and you did. So as you say now that you're not going to negotiate on the debt ceiling this year, why should House Republicans take that seriously and think that if we get to the 1 minute to midnight scenario, that you're not going to back down?
Well, first of all, Juliana, let's take the example of this year in the fiscal cliff. I didn't say that I would not have any conversations at all about extending the Bush tax cuts. What I said was we weren't going to extend Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. And we didn't. Now, you can argue that during the campaign I said I set the criteria for wealthy at 250, and we ended up being at 400. But the fact of the matter is millionaires, billionaires are paying significantly more in taxes, just as I said. So from the start, my concern was making sure that we had a tax code that was fair and that protected the middle class, and my biggest priority was making sure the middle class taxes did not go up. The difference between this year and 2011 is the fact that we've already made $1.2 trillion in cuts. And at the time, I indicated that there were cuts that we could sensibly make that would not damage our economy, would not impede growth. I said at the time, I think we should pair it up with revenue in order to have an overall balanced package. But my own budget reflected cuts in discretionary spending. My own budget reflected the cuts that needed to be made. And we've made those cuts. Now, the challenge going forward is that we've now made some big cuts. And if we're going to do further deficit reduction, the only way to do it is in a balanced and responsible way. The alternative is for us to go ahead and cut commitments that we've made on things like Medicare or Social Security or Medicaid, and for us to fundamentally change commitments that we've made to make sure that seniors don't go into poverty, or that children who are disabled or properly cared for. For us to change that contract we've made with the American people, rather than look at options like closing loopholes for corporations that they don't need, that points to a long-term trend in which we have fundamentally, I think, undermined what people expect out of this government, which is that parties sit down, they negotiate, they compromise, but they also reflect the will of the American people, that you don't have one narrow faction that is able to simply dictate 100% of what they want all the time or otherwise threaten that we destroy the American economy. Another way of putting it is we've got to break the habit of negotiating through crisis over and over again. And now is as good of a time as any at the start of my second term, because if we continue down this path, then there's really no stopping the principle. I mean, literally, even in divided government, even where we've got a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate, then a small group in the House of Representatives could simply say, every 2 months, every 3 months, every 6 months, every year, we are going to more and more change the economy in ways that we prefer, despite strong objections of Americans all across the country, or otherwise we're going to have America not pay its bills. And that is no way for us to do business. And by the way, I would make the same argument if it was a Republican president and a Republican Senate, and you had a handful of Democrats who were suggesting that we are going to hijack the process and make sure that either we get our way 100% of the time or otherwise we are going to default on America's obligations. No. Look, what I've said is that I'm happy to have a conversation about deficit reduction. No. Juliana, look, this is pretty straightforward. Either Congress pays its bills or it doesn't. Now, if they want to keep this responsibility, if John Boehner and Mitch McConnell think that they can come up with a plan that somehow meets their criteria that they've set for why they will, when they will raise the debt ceiling, they're free to go ahead and try. But the proposals that they've put forward in order to accomplish that, only by cutting spending, means cuts to things like Medicare and education that the American people profoundly reject. Now, if they think that they can get that through Congress, then they're free to try. But I think that a better way of doing this is to go ahead and say, we're going to pay our bills. The question now is, how do we actually get our deficit in a manageable, sustainable way? And that's a conversation I'm happy to have. All right. Matt Spitalnik.
Thank you, sir. You've spoken extensively about the debt ceiling debate, but some Republicans have further said that they're willing to allow a government shutdown to take place rather than put off deep spending cuts. Are you prepared to allow the government to grind to a halt if you disagree with the spending cut proposals that they put forth? And who do you think the American people would blame if that came to pass?
Well, ultimately, Congress makes the decisions about whether or not we spend money and whether or not we keep this government open. And if the Republicans in Congress have made a decision that they want to shut down the government in order to get their way, then they have the votes, at least in the House of Representatives, probably to do that. I think that would be a mistake. I think it would be profoundly damaging to our economy. I think it would actually add to our deficit because it will impede growth. I think it's short-sighted. But they're elected representatives, and folks put them into those positions, and they're going to have to make a decision about that. And I suspect that the American people would blame all of Washington for not being able to get its act together. But the larger issue here has to do with what is it that we're trying to accomplish? Are we trying to reduce the deficit? Because if we're trying to reduce the deficit, then we can shape a bipartisan plan to reduce the deficit. I mean, is that really our objective? Our concern is that we're spending more than we take in, and if that's the case, then there's a way of balancing that out so that we take in more money, increasing revenue, and we reduce spending. And there's a recipe for getting that done. And in the conversation that I had with Speaker Boehner before the end of the year, we came pretty close. I mean, a few hundred billion dollars separating us when stretched out over a 10-year period, that's not a lot. But it seems as if what's motivating and propelling at this point some of the House Republicans is more than simply deficit reduction. They have a particular vision about what government should and should not do. So they are suspicious about government's commitments, for example, to make sure that seniors have decent health care as they get older. They have suspicions about Social Security. They have suspicions about whether government should make sure that kids in poverty are getting enough to eat, or whether we should be spending money on medical research. So they've got a particular view of what government should do and should be. And you know, that view was rejected by the American people when it was debated during the presidential campaign. I think every poll that's out there indicates that the American people actually think our commitment to Medicare or to education is really important. And that's something that we should look at as a last resort in terms of reducing the deficit. And it makes a lot more sense for us to close, for example, corporate loopholes before we go to putting a bigger burden on students or seniors. But if the House Republicans disagree with that and they want to shut down the government to see if they can get their way on it, that's their prerogative. That's how the system's set up. It will damage our economy. You know, the government is a big part of this economy. And it's interesting that a lot of times you have people who recognize that when it comes to defense spending. You know, some of the same folks who say we got to cut spending or complain that you know, government jobs don't do anything, when it comes to that defense contractor in their district, they think, wow, this is a pretty important part of the economy in my district. And we shouldn't stop spending on that. Let's just make sure we're not spending on those other folks.
So
my hope is that common sense prevails. You know, that's always my preference. And I think that would be the preference of the American people, and that's what would be good for the economy. So let me just repeat. If the issue is deficit reduction, getting our deficits sustainable over time, getting our debt in a sustainable place, then Democrats and Republicans in Congress will have a partner with me. We can achieve that, and yeah, we can achieve it fairly quickly. I mean, we know what the numbers are. We know what needs to be done. We know what a balanced approach would take. We've already done probably more than half of the deficit reduction we need to stabilize the debt and the deficit. There's probably been more pain and drama in getting there than we needed. And so finishing the job shouldn't be that difficult if everybody comes to the conversation with an open mind, and if we recognize that there's some things, like not paying our bills, that should be out of bounds. All right? I'm going to take one last question. Jackie Combs. Yep.
I'd like to ask you,
it's a presidential news conference
on
NPR.
Of your first term, starting your second, about a couple of criticisms, one that's longstanding, another more recent. The longstanding one seems to have become a truism of sorts that you and your staff are too insular, that you don't socialize enough. And the second, the more recent criticism, is that your team taking shape isn't as diverse as it could be or even was in terms of getting additional voices, gender, race, ethnic diversity. So I'd like you to address both of those.
Sure. Let me take the second one first. I'm very proud that in the first 4 years, we had as diverse, if not more diverse, a White House and a cabinet than any in history. And I intend to continue that, because it turns out that when you look for the very best people, given the incredible diversity of this country, you're going to end up with a diverse staff and a diverse team. And that very diversity helps to create more effective policymaking and better decision-making for me, because it brings different perspectives to the table. So if you think about my first 4 years, the person who probably had the most influence on my foreign policy was a woman. The people who were in charge of moving forward my most important domestic initiative, healthcare, were women. The person in charge of our homeland security was a woman. My two appointments to the Supreme Court were women, and 50% of my White House staff were women. So I think people should expect that that record will be built upon during the next 4 years. Now, what I've made, four appointments so far, and one woman, admittedly a high-profile one, is leaving the has already left the administration, and I have made a replacement. But I would just suggest that everybody kind of wait until they've seen all my appointments, who's in the White House staff and who's in my cabinet, before they rush to judgment. But I guess what I'm saying, Jackie, is that I think until you've seen what my overall team looks like, it's premature to assume that somehow we're going backwards. We're not going backwards. We're going forward. With respect to this truism about me not socializing enough and patting folks on the back and all that stuff, most people who know me know I'm a pretty friendly guy. And I like a good party. And, the truth is that, when I was in the Senate, I had great relationships over there, and up until the point that I became president, this was not an accusation that you heard very frequently. I think that really what's gone on in terms of some of the paralysis here in Washington or difficulties in negotiations just have to do with some very stark differences in terms of policy, some very sharp differences in terms of where we stand on issues. And, if you think about, let's say, myself and Speaker Boehner, I like Speaker Boehner personally. And, when we went out and played golf, we had a great time, but that didn't get a deal done in 2011. When I'm over here at the congressional picnic and folks are coming up and taking pictures with their family, I promise you, Michelle and I are very nice to them, and we have a wonderful time. But it doesn't prevent them from going under the floor of the House and, blasting me for being a big spending socialist. And the reason that, in many cases Congress votes the way they do or talks the way they talk or takes positions in negotiations that they take doesn't have to do with me. It has to do with the imperatives that they feel in terms of their own politics, right? They're worried about their district. They're worried about what's going on back home. I think there are a lot of Republicans at this point that feel that given how much energy has been devoted in some of the media that's preferred by Republican constituencies to demonize me, that it doesn't look real good socializing with me. Charlie Crist down in Florida, I think, testifies to that. And I think a lot of folks say, well, you know, if we look like we're being too cooperative or too chummy with the president, that might cause us problems. That might be an excuse for us to get a challenge from somebody in a primary. So that tends to be the challenge. I promise you, we invite folks from Congress over here all the time, and when they choose to come, I enjoy their company. Sometimes they don't choose to come, and that has to do with the fact that I think they don't consider the optics useful for them politically. And ultimately, the way we're going to get stuff done, personal relationships are important. And obviously, I can always do a better job. And the nice thing is that now that my girls are getting older, they don't want to spend that much time with me anyway. So I'll be probably calling around looking for somebody to play cards with me or something, because I'm getting kind of lonely in this big house. So maybe a whole bunch of members of the House Republican Caucus want to come over and socialize more. But my suspicion is getting the issues resolved that we just talked about, the big stuff, whether or not we get sensible laws passed to prevent gun violence, whether or not America's paying its bills, whether or not we get immigration reform done. All that's going to be determined largely by where the respective parties stand on policy, and maybe most importantly, the attitude of the American people. Now, if the American people feel strongly about these issues and they push hard and they reward or don't reward members of Congress with their votes, if they reject sort of uncompromising positions or sharp partisanship or always looking out for the next election, and they reward folks who are trying to find common ground, then I think you'll see behavior in Congress change. And that'll be true whether I'm the life of the party or a stick of the mud. All right. Thank you very much, everybody.
President Barack Obama in the East Room of the White House. Near the end of his news conference, he spoke a sentence I'm not sure I've ever heard a president say. "I'm a pretty friendly guy," unquote, saying that he is willing to socialize with Republicans. But, of course, the big question is how, if at all, they will work out major, major differences in the weeks and months ahead. Just to review very briefly, the president said that he is still not willing to negotiate with Republicans over raising the federal debt ceiling. He was insistent on framing that in the way that he wants, that this is simply paying America's bills, not adding new debt. He did warn that if the debt ceiling is not raised, the debt limit is not raised, that Social Security benefits and veterans benefits will be delayed. He talked of other things that could happen. He spoke specifically of those benefits being delayed, said they will be delayed. There was much discussion in this news conference of how to look at this negotiation or non-negotiation over the debt ceiling, and a number of other issues came up as well. There was brief mention of guns and extraordinarily brief mention of immigration, but the debt ceiling dominated this news conference, as some lawmakers expected to dominate the weeks and months ahead. Let's talk about this a little bit with some of our correspondents who've been listening in. First NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, did you hear anything that sounded new to you?
Well, the president, as you say, is continuing to take his hard line on the debt ceiling. And he said, we've got to break the habit of negotiating through crisis. And he said, this is where I'm drawing the line. But he also said, now's as good a time as any. And I think there are some who would disagree with that, who would have said, well, look, you might have drawn that firm line in the sand over the fiscal cliff, for example, when the stakes would have been much lower. You wouldn't have had the full faith and credit of the United States on the line. He didn't do that. And as one of the reporters questioning him said, you know, there have been times in the past when you've said, I'm not going to negotiate, and then you've proceeded to negotiate. So it's going to be a question whether Republicans are going to take this threat seriously coming from the White House.
And the president, because there's so many things out there, so many things to be negotiated, also put himself in the position of saying, well, if we want to talk about reducing spending, we can talk about that. If we want to talk about a balanced deficit reduction, is actually how he phrased it, we can talk about that, but I don't want to talk about this other thing. Is he in a position where he's going to have to negotiate whether he wants to call it that or not?
Well, he's going to have to negotiate over the what he wants to see as a balanced deficit package. Whether that comes in the context of the debt ceiling or not, as we've talked about the other deadlines that are looming out there, the auto automatic spending cuts, the just getting the money to keep the government's lights on. So there is going to be this ongoing conversation about the debt ceiling, about the balanced deficit reduction. And he said, look, we don't even have that far to go on that. We've already trimmed the deficit by $2.5 trillion over a decade, another $1.5 trillion. That's a lot of money to you and me, but in Washington, it's a doable thing. But I'm not going to have that conversation, he said, with a gun pointed at the American people's head.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about that. And by the way, we do have a statement already from Mitch McConnell, the leading Senate Republican. The president is saying here today he's not going to negotiate over the debt ceiling, that paying America's bills is not the time to have this broader discussion about the deficit. Mitch McConnell comes right back at him and says, quote, the president and his allies need to get serious about spending, and the debt limit debate is the perfect time for it. Tamara Keith, NPR's Tamara Keith, who covers Congress and is with us. This is going right back at the president. You are going to talk about this.
And whether he wants to call it a negotiation or not, this conversation is going to happen about the deficit. One thing to point out is one reason why he can't negotiate over the debt ceiling is that he promised congressional Democrats he wouldn't negotiate over the debt ceiling. And that's partially how he got them to agree to the fiscal cliff deal. So whatever you call it, he, at least for now, is insisting he's not negotiating over it. And I was watching the Twitter sphere out there, and you know, the response from congressional Republicans and their allies was pretty strong. The very firm line that the president was taking made them very unhappy, and basically they're saying this just proves he's not willing to negotiate with them. He's an unreasonable guy.
And of course, who's reasonable and who's unreasonable is a big question here. It gets into how you frame it, how you frame the history. The president is insisting this is unprecedented. This didn't used to happen. Now you have people demanding ransom, and he says, I will not pay ransom. He used the word ransom. Major Garrett of Fox News, one of the reporters who asked a question, went right back at him, and he suggested a completely different reading of Major Garrett of CBS, excuse me, formerly of Fox News, now of CBS. He talked of a new adamant desire not to negotiate. He's saying, listen, there's always been deal making over the debt ceiling, Mr. President. Suddenly you don't want to play that game. It is you who is being extraordinary. Can I ask, is anybody here willing to tell us who's right?
Well, there have always been demands made in the past. What the president argued is new is this demand that John Boehner made in the 2011 debt ceiling talks, which is that any dollar increase in the debt ceiling must be accompanied by a dollar cut in federal spending. There is no actual logical relationship between those two things. It's a demand that the Republicans have put in place. And what the president has said is, look, we've already got $1.2 trillion in automatic spending cuts we're going to try to replace. Mm-hmm. We need another, say, $1.2 trillion in headroom under the debt ceiling just to keep the government functioning for another year or so. Add those two together, you're talking $2.4 trillion. The Republicans don't have a clue where they would get $2.4 trillion in spending cuts that would not be politically impossible.
And this is another part of the president's argument, the numbers that you're talking about, Scott Horsley, because the president argued again and again, we've already done a lot of the work here. We've already imposed a lot of spending cuts. We've already agreed to this tax increase. We've actually improved the long-term outlook for the deficit. If you look at all the numbers, and there's so many ways to look at them and project them, is the deficit long-term actually better than it was a year or two ago?
It's better than it was before they raised the revenue and before they cut the spending in those ways, sure. And as the president said, they're now within sight of actually getting the $4 trillion that you'd need to have the debt stop growing and have the debt be what they call a sustainable level. That's, you know, again, $1.5 trillion is not nothing, but it's they are, as he said, more than halfway there.
Okay, thanks very much. That's NPR's Scott Horsley and NPR's Tamara Keith. We were also joined by NPR's Carrie Johnson, thanks to you, and NPR's Tom Bowman as well, listening in from the Pentagon. The president holding a news conference of a little less than an hour today, answering questions mostly on a looming fight over the budget and the debt ceiling, briefly addressing other issues as well, describing what is being demanded by House Republicans as a ransom that he will not pay, stating that he still will not negotiate over the debt ceiling. A deadline is coming up in the weeks ahead. NPR will have more coverage of the news conference throughout the day on the air and online. It's special coverage from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.